Good morning and welcome to the Wednesday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day. Here are all the books Hillary Clinton name drops in her new memoir by Ryan Teague Beckwith. Hillary Clinton doesn't just want you to read her campaign memoir. Turns out she thinks you should read a few more books. In What Happened, the former Secretary of State reflects on her failed presidential campaign, reflecting on her concerns about the direction President Trump is taking the country and how she handled her loss. Clinton peppers the book with references to books that she thinks help explain Trump's rise and how America should respond to it, as well as poems, novels, and essays that inspired her and helped her cope with her loss. Here's a look at the book she name-checks. Classic dystopian novels. Clinton references several classic dystopian novels, which became bestsellers again during the Trump administration. Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, George Orwell's 1984, and Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale, which was recently turned into a Hulu series. On Tyranny. Clinton quotes a line about anti-democratic leaders who sow distrust of facts from Yale history professor Timothy Snyder's 2017 bestseller about lessons that can be learned from past totalitarian regimes. The Assault on Reason. Clinton calls former Vice President Al Gore's 2007 book about how politicians are sowing distrust in the public sphere prescient. The Power of the Powerless. Clinton says that after the election, she reread the former Czech Republic president's essay about how individuals can fight back against authoritarian regimes. Mystery novels. Clinton says she took solace in reading mystery novels by Louise Penny, Jacqueline Winspear, Donna Leon, and Charles Todd, as well as Elena Ferrante's four Neapolitan novels. Inspirational poetry. Clinton says she took solace after her loss in several inspirational poems. William Ernest Henley's Invictus, which was a favorite of Nelson Mandela's, Maya Angelou's Still I Rise, and T.S. Eliot's poem East Coker from Four Quartets. Strong for a Moment Like This. Clinton cites a book of devotionals from United Methodist minister Bill Shillady, who officiated at Chelsea Clinton's wedding. Return of the Prodigal Son. Clinton says after the election, she reread a book by Dutch priest Henri Nguyen, which she says she's turned to during past difficult times. Emily Doe's Letter. Clinton cites a viral letter from an anonymous woman who was sexually assaulted by a Stanford student that was read aloud in court. Wild. Clinton quotes Cheryl Strayed's book about hiking the Pacific Crest Trail. Lean In. Clinton references the book about women in the workplace written by her friend, Facebook Chief Operating Officer Sheryl Sandberg, noting a section on how professionally successful women are often disliked. Her own books. Clinton references her previous autobiography, Hard Choices, noting that it was long, more than 600 pages about foreign policy, but that she had a lot more things I wanted to say. She also references It Takes a Village and Chelsea Clinton's children's book, She Persisted. The Boys on the Bus. Clinton name-checks Timothy Krause's nonfiction book about the 1972 election. During the 1972 presidential campaign, the reporters who traveled with the candidates were called the Boys on the Bus. By 2016, it was the Girls on the Plane. Classic books. Clinton notes that her daughter Chelsea loved the science fiction classic A Wrinkle in Time and Gabriel Garcia Marquez's 100 Years of Solitude. She quotes Khalil Gibran's beloved book of poetry, The Prophet, on having children. Great Expectations. Clinton says she does not want to spend the rest of her life like Miss Havisham, the jilted bride from Charles Dickens' Great Expectations, who spends the rest of her life rattling around her house, obsessing over what might have been. Game of Thrones. Clinton says that crowd at Trump rallies chanted guilty, guilty about her, like the religious zealots in Game of Thrones chanting shame, shame. The Clue of the Tapping Heels. Clinton notes that Nancy Drew would often do her detective work in sensible trousers, quoting a line from the 1939 mystery book where she says, "I'm glad I wore pants." American history. Clinton says her bookshelves are stuffed with U.S. history and biographies of presidents, but says she couldn't read them after the election. She recounts reading Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America in college, calls Alexander Hamilton's defense of the Electoral College as a bulwark against foreign influence in Federalist Paper No. 68 ironic, and quotes Lin-Manuel Miranda's Hamilton. Devil's Bargain. Clinton quotes Bloomberg News reporter Joshua Green's recent book about Steve Bannon and Donald Trump. The Destruction of Hillary Clinton. Clinton cites the gender studies in Professor Susan Bordo's book to say that the anger about her at Trump rallies was almost medieval. With Liberty and Dividends for All. Clinton says that before running for president, she read Peter Barnes's book about creating a universal basic income program to pay dividends to every American, similar to Alaska's permanent fund, but said her team couldn't make the numbers work. A Black Man in the White House. Clinton cites Democratic pollster Cornell Belcher's book about a backlash in racial attitudes during the Obama administration. Bowling Alone. Clinton cites Harvard professor Bob Putnam's book about a breakdown in American civil society. The estimated costs of Hurricanes Irma and Harvey are already higher than Katrina. By Rob Weil. Two of America's largest and most populated states are still reeling from Hurricanes Harvey and Irma, but one organization is already saying that 2017 is shaping up as the costliest hurricane season ever. AccuWeather estimates that the costs of the storms on South Florida, Southeast Texas, and other affected regions will be a total of $290 billion. This is the first time in recorded history that two Category 4 or higher hurricanes had struck the U.S. mainland in the same year, AccuWeather noted. That is extraordinary by itself, AccuWeather founder Dr. Joel N. Myers said in the report. Also unprecedented is that this particular storm, Irma, has sustained intensity for the longest period of time of any hurricane or typhoon in any ocean of the world since the satellite era began. For perspective, the estimated costs for Hurricane Katrina ranged between $108 and $250 billion. Other estimates put the combined cost of the 2005 hurricane season, which included Katrina, Rita, and Wilma, at nearly $200 billion in 2017 dollars. According to AccuWeather, Harvey's damage estimate is $190 billion, while the costs of Irma will be roughly $100 billion. The costs associated with these storms include disruption to business, unemployment periods lasting up to months, transportation and infrastructure damages, crop loss including 25% of orange crop, increased fuel prices, and property damages. Last week, President Trump signed a $15 billion disaster relief bill. AccuWeather's assessment is on the higher end of projected costs. On Monday, Enki Research's estimate for total damages from Irma dropped to $49 billion from $200 billion, as the storm's brush with the western coast of Florida appears to have been less damaging than expected, Bloomberg reported. On the other hand, one analyst cited by The Guardian said the overall economic cost of Irma alone could reach $300 billion, with insurance companies on the hook to cover perhaps half the damages and cleanup expenses. The EU agency fighting Russia's wildfire of fake news with a hose pipe. By Charlotte MacDonald Gibson. In 2015, as Russia plunged millions of dollars into an escalating disinformation campaign against the West, the European Union's defense consisted of just one person. A former journalist had been seconded from the Czech Republic to the EU's newly established East Stratcom Task Force and was working furiously to debunk the Kremlin-backed fake news that flooded people's inboxes, TV screens, and social media timelines. He was working literally 7 days a week, said an EU official involved in the bloc's strategic communications efforts, who asked for anonymity in order to speak freely. He was going to an early grave if we didn't get some help. Getting help proved tricky. Despite a clear and explicitly stated aim from Moscow to use disinformation as part of its foreign policy, the EU moved at its customary slow pace. Some countries didn't really feel a threat, said the official, citing the usual divisions which plague a coordinated EU response. While places like the Baltic nations, Poland, and Scandinavia, having been victims of Russian disinformation for years, advocated a robust response, others, including Hungary and southern European nations which depend on Russian investment or energy, were less enthusiastic. Even Germany wasn't particularly supportive, the official said. They were not really convinced there was a problem. The U.S. elections apparently helped change their minds, with Moscow accused of deploying hacking and other means of disinformation to sway the result of the 2016 presidential election. In September, it emerged that 3,300 Russia-backed ads had appeared on Facebook during the 2016 election campaign. Now, East Stratcom is enjoying a reversal of fortune. On a recent visit to their headquarters in a bright and modern building in the heart of the EU district, staff were busy putting together their weekly newsletter. They've built a volunteer network of 500 NGOs, diplomats, think tanks, and other media professionals who regularly send them examples of fake news. These are then debunked in the newsletter on Facebook and Twitter. The efforts come as a string of high-profile European elections has raised awareness of Russia's attempts to destabilize the democratic process. In the Netherlands, authorities reverted to counting ballots by hand to thwart any attempts at hacking in March elections. New French President Emmanuel Macron called Kremlin-funded media outlets RT and Sputnik agents of influence, which spread rumors about him during the campaign. In Germany, which holds elections later this month, false reports on Russian media of a migrant raping a 13-year-old Russian-German girl brought thousands of people out onto the street in protest, giving Berlin a wake-up call in the powers of propaganda. But combating Russia's propaganda networks remain a David and Goliath struggle, the EU official conceded. The Kremlin's efforts to destabilize the EU and promote pro-Russian policy are alleged to include outright hacking, backing for anti-EU political parties, heavily biased news reporting, and an army of internet trolls who stalk social media with pro-Russian messages. East Stratcom will have expanded to 14 employees by the end of this year, but only three of them are working full-time on debunking disinformation. Their Twitter feed has around 27,000 followers, compared to 2.62 million for RT, while its Facebook page has just over 17,000 likes. Sputnik has over a million. The EU's leadership says there's only so much it can do, given the resources it's already pouring into multiple crises within Europe. Speaking to Time in an interview in February, European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker said he was certain that the Russians are trying by all the means they have to have a propaganda influence on European and international affairs. But he added, they have thousands of people telling stories which do not reflect reality. We have only a few people rebutting these because I don't want to engage 1,000 new civil servants to react. Maza Kozanicic, the spokesperson for EU Foreign Affairs, told Time in July that East Stratcom is doing an excellent job operating within their current allocated resources. But for some, those allocated resources border on the negligent. In an open letter published in March, more than 120 signatories from across government, media, security, and civil society accused the EU of being irresponsibly weak on disinformation. The European Parliament, meanwhile, called on the EU to more than double the staff of East Stratcom and give it a budget in the millions. The 28 EU governments declined to back that proposal, and the unit still does not have its own budget, relying on a small share of the EU's existing strategic communications budget. and the threat is far from over. As well as German elections on September 24th, there are fears of Russian meddling in elections in Sweden in 2018 and in the European Parliament elections in 2019. "We are still reactive, not proactive," said Petras Auštrevičius, a Lithuanian member of the European Parliament and one of the signatories of the open letter. Auštrevičius advocates more radical measures to curb the influence of Russian media. "I do not exclude a cutoff of the broadcasters," he said. "If they are really hostile against us, against our values, we should not shy away from taking even more principled measures." He also thinks a proposed German law, which would fine social media platforms up to $50 million if they fail to promptly remove illegal content, should be expanded throughout the EU. Earlier this year, the EU Commissioner for the Digital Economy, Andris Ansip, told the Financial Times that while he would prefer social media sites to pursue self-regulatory measures, they could be complemented by some kind of clarifications. He did not expand on what those might be, and replying to a question from Time, his spokesperson once again stressed that these media carry the main responsibility to act against fake news. So, for now, East Stratcom remains on the front line. A recent edition of the newsletter took on an implausible story published on Russian and Lithuanian news websites about an American B-52 plane dropping a nuclear bomb on a Lithuanian town. "If a tree falls in the forest and there's nobody around to hear, does it make a sound?" he asks. "What about a nuclear bomb that falls over a Lithuanian town and no one notices?" But the question is, above the din of the Russian propaganda machine, can anyone hear the EU? Here's how much you need to make to be in the top 10%, by Ian Salisbury. The top 10% of earners made at least $170,500 last year, nearly three times the amount the typical American household earned. The new figures come from the Census Bureau's annual study of incomes, poverty, and health insurance in the U.S. Within the report, there were several nuggets to be optimistic about. After stalling out following the housing crisis, middle-class incomes are growing again at a healthy rate. The median income in the U.S. is now $59,000, which rose by more than $1,800 from $57,200 in 2015. That 3.2% gain, which accounts for inflation, was only slightly below the 3.7% gain that the top 5% of earners enjoyed. The poverty rate also declined last year by 0.8 percentage points to 12.7%. How the Census Bureau defines poverty depends on household. For the classic nuclear family with two adults and two kids, the income threshold is just over $24,000. For a lone senior, it's roughly $11,500, according to Reuters. In all, the Census Bureau said, there were 40.6 million people living in poverty last year, 2.5 million fewer than in 2015. One thing that could boost the fortunes of the wealthy in 2017 and 2018 is Trump's tax plan, currently being peddled by Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin. While details are still sketchy, one analysis by the Tax Policy Center found it would hand the top 5% of earners, which the TPC estimated as taking in $308,000 and up, would see an average tax cut of more than $25,000. Those in the middle fifth of the income spectrum would also see a cut, albeit a smaller one, worth about $2,000 on average. Hurricane Irma's devastation lingers in the Caribbean, by Tara John in Antigua. Close to a week after Hurricane Irma tore through the Caribbean, a number of the hardest-hit island states and territories in the region are dealing with dwindling supplies and a stunning breakdown in law and order. Residents living on islands of the French-administered St. Martin and the British territory of Anguilla say they feel cut off from the world after flooding and winds destroyed vital telephone infrastructure and electricity, leaving tens of thousands in darkness. Electricity is down, and they're saying it may be down for years, Anguilla resident Imogen Go, 49, told Time on Tuesday. She says her neighbor's roof flew into the front of her home and that she's down to her last liter and a half of water. There have been reports of mass looting on the island of St. Martin, where more than 90% of the structures have been destroyed. Dutch King Willem Alexander visited his country's half of the island on Monday, telling Dutch National Network NOS that the destruction was the worst he'd ever seen. Looting also started soon after Hurricane Irma hit the Caribbean island of Tortola. Andy, 48, who was visiting the largest island of the British Virgin Islands to upgrade a cable, says witnessing it was as terrifying as living through Category 5 hurricane. Despite the police being there, the looters were indiscriminately roaming around the hotel with big knives, Andy, who declined to give his surname, said on Sunday after arriving to Antigua. I was lucky because I had some cell service and my company chartered a plane to get me out, but I think other tourists are probably still stuck there. Around 20,000 children have been affected in the hurricane-hit Caribbean countries, and more than 130 schools are beyond repair across Anguilla, Antigua, and Barbuda, the Virgin Islands, and Turks and Caicos, according to UNICEF. Joe English, a spokesperson for the organization, witnessed long lines snaking around gas stations in Anguilla as people attempt to get fuel for generators. The Red Cross, UNICEF, and partners are distributing essential supplies, including food, safe water, and hygiene kits, but the needs are immense, he said in an email. Go, who is from Canada and has lived in Anguilla for about 4 years, said the island's water supply has been cut off since Irma made landfall on Wednesday. Supermarkets are selling bottled water, but there's only one working cash machine on the island. If you can't get cash, you can't get water, she said. From what I've seen as an eyewitness, the UK government has been pretty dismal, but thankfully the people here are patient and the community has been helping each other out. As reports of desperation mount, governments of France, Britain, and the Netherlands, who administer a number of territories in the region, have had to defend themselves against criticism over their response to the disaster. The Netherlands announced that it was sending extra troops to the Dutch side of St. Martin, and French President Emmanuel Macron promised to rebuild his country's overseas territories destroyed by the hurricane. He added that 11 people have died in St. Bart's and St. Martin, raising Irma's overall death toll to at least 38. British Foreign Minister Boris Johnson defended the country's response to the unprecedented catastrophe on the BBC on Monday. He will be flying into the region, and Britain's Department for International Development says 1,000 military troops have been deployed, providing shelter kits, food, and water in Tortola and Anguilla. For Go, help couldn't come sooner. My neighbors and their 4 children are drinking water from a contaminated cistern, he said. All we really are living on is hope. How Edith Windsor Became a Matriarch of the Gay Rights Movement by Olivia B. Waxman. For most of her life, Edith Windsor was a private citizen who, like most Americans, had a name that, while meaningful to those in her circle of friends and family, was largely unknown to the wider world. But a late-in-life decision ensured that the LGBTQ activist, who died on Tuesday at 88 years old, as her wife Judith Kaysen Windsor confirmed, would find her name a solid part of American history. After all, it's her name in the 2013 Supreme Court case United States v. Windsor, which overturned key parts of the Defense of Marriage Act. America's long journey towards equality has been guided by countless small acts of persistence and fueled by the stubborn willingness of quiet heroes to speak out for what's right, former President Barack Obama said in a statement about Windsor's death. Few were as small in stature as Edie Windsor, and few made as big a difference to America. The Windsor decision said that in 13 states and the District of Columbia, which recognized same-sex marriage, such couples were entitled to the same federal benefits offered to their heterosexual counterparts. On the wider question of whether marriage equality is a constitutional right, the Supreme Court ruled that it is in 2015, and that same-sex marriages must be recognized in all states. In 2013, in the wake of that decision, Time named her a finalist for Person of the Year, describing her as the matriarch of the gay rights movement. Here's how the magazine described her rise to prominence, which started when her first wife, Thea Speier, died in 2009. Windsor's judicial odyssey began in 2010 when she sued the government for a $363,053 refund of the estate taxes she had to pay when her spouse died. Under the Defense of Marriage Act, a federal law passed in 1996, the couple's legal marriage in Canada in 2007 didn't qualify them for any federal protections, including the estate tax exemption for surviving spouses. When the Supreme Court decided 5-4 in Windsor's favor on June 26th, it declared DOMA, which excluded gay married couples from some 1,100 federal provisions like filing joint tax returns and accessing veterans benefits, unconstitutional. The decision marked the first time the U.S. recognized marriage between partners of the same sex. It was a big win. Windsor now finds herself transformed into an icon of the gay rights movement. She wears the mantle well. Feisty, funny, and extroverted, Windsor has been, at different points in her life, a leader. At 13, she was elected vice president of her 8th grade class. In the 1960s and early 70s, after developing a precocious expertise in computer programming at IBM, she managed, at times reluctant, men. The homes she shared with Speier in New York City and the Hamptons were salons for many people in the gay and lesbian community. The couple's love and tenacity empowered the rest of us as we were coming up, says historian and friend Blanche Wieson Cook. As part of the feature, Windsor shared with Time photo albums of her first marriage and her Greenwich Village apartment. I think the truth is that if you really care about the quality of somebody's life as much as you care about the quality of your own, she said, you have it made. Apple announces its 10th anniversary iPhone X. Here's What to Know by Lisa Edichico. Apple just announced the iPhone X, its much-anticipated 10th anniversary iPhone. With a brand new design that includes an edge-to-edge screen, it's the biggest change to the iPhone Apple has made in years. As expected, the phone starts at $999 and will ship on November 3rd. Pre-orders for the new phone start on October 27th. The first iPhone revolutionized a decade of technology, Apple CEO Tim Cook said on stage. Now, 10 years later, it's only fitting that we're here in this place on this day to reveal a product that will set the path for technology for the next decade. It's the first iPhone to come with an OLED screen, which is a different type of display technology that offers richer blacks and better overall contrast. The iPhone X will be available in gray and silver finishes and includes a new screen Apple calls a Super Retina display. It measures 5.8 inches diagonally and has a 2436 by 1135 pixel resolution. It's also the first and only iPhone without a home button. Instead, you'll wake up the phone by simply tapping the screen. Users will now swipe up from the bottom of the screen to navigate back to the home screen and launch the app switcher. One of the biggest changes coming to the iPhone X, though, is facial recognition. This new Face ID feature is powered by a multi-optical system that includes an infrared camera, a dot projector, and an ambient light sensor. Apple says the technology will also work in the dark and in real time, whether you're wearing glasses or other accessories that may obscure the face. More importantly, Apple says it can't be spoofed by photographs, which has been an issue with rival Samsung's phones. Face ID will work with Apple Pay and third-party apps as well. Apple showcased how its new facial recognition system could be used in Snapchat. When demonstrating the phone on stage, Apple's Craig Federighi showed how the app's mask-like filters fit more accurately on the face. The iPhone X's rear cameras are getting some improvements as well. Like the iPhone 8 Plus, it will have two cameras outfitted with 12-megapixel sensors. Last year's iPhone 7 Plus had a 12-megapixel camera on the rear, but only a 7-megapixel camera at front. This phone, however, also has dual optical image stabilization, which means both cameras will be less susceptible to visual errors in shaky hands. Like Apple's other new iPhones, the iPhone X will support wireless charging. Apple's also launching a new charging mat that can be used to charge the iPhone X, Apple Watch, and AirPods at the same time and distribute the power evenly, dubbed the Air Power Charger. Here's Why Most Americans Prefer to Treat Pain Without Drugs, by Alexandra Sifferlin. In the midst of an opioid addiction epidemic, a new survey of Americans has found that most prefer to try a non-drug approach to treating their pain over taking medications prescribed by their doctor. The new report, part of the Gallup-Palmer College of Chiropractic Annual Study of Americans, surveyed about 6,300 adults. Nearly two-thirds said that they had neck or back pain so great they sought a healthcare provider for relief, and 54% said they had neck or back pain for at least 5 years. Yet 78% said they preferred to try other ways to address their physical pain before taking drugs. Still, many Americans said they have taken painkillers, both prescription and non-prescription, for their pain. 70% took a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug, NSAID, such as aspirin, in the last year, and 25% took opioids. Of the non-drug options for pain, Americans believed that physical therapy was the safest and most effective, followed by chiropractic care. Both methods were rated higher than prescription drugs for effectiveness and perceived safety. Other methods included back surgery and self-care, but they were not as popular. The popularity of alternative methods for treating pain and the high desire to avoid prescription drugs may reflect Americans' attitudes toward opioids in general. In a 2016 survey, 44% of Americans said they viewed opioids as a crisis or a very serious problem for their area. While public perceptions of options for drug-free pain management vary, these findings suggest that Americans are aware of the dangers associated with opioid misuse and are open to drug-free alternatives for pain management, the study authors write. These developments could be a sign of a future where patients and healthcare professionals alike are trying drug-free treatment options before relying on opioids. Nintendo is releasing way more Super NES Classic Editions than originally planned, by Jennifer Kalfas. Nintendo fans, it appears your prayers have been answered with the Super NES Classic Edition. Nintendo plans to not only increase the inventory of the Super NES Classic Edition when it hits shelves on September 29th, but to also ship them through the new year, the company announced Tuesday morning. Pre-orders of the retro game console sold out in minutes at a variety of retailers as fans eagerly await the release of the $79.99 throwback to the 1990s. Fans have shown their unbridled enthusiasm for these classic edition systems, so Nintendo is working to put many more of them on store shelves, the company said in a statement. The Super NES Classic Edition, which is small enough to fit in your hand, is slated to hit shelves later this month and already appears to be one of the season's hottest products. The 16-bit console comes with 20 classic games, including Super Mario World and Super Mario Kart, as well as the never-released Star Fox 2. A number of retailers are selling the product, including GameStop, Best Buy, Amazon, Target, Walmart, and Toys R Us. Customers have also found the Super NES Classic Edition at ThinkGeek, which GameStop owns, and eBay, where users are selling the popular item for higher prices. All of the pre-sales held at the end of August have long been sold out. But this will not be the only retro product Nintendo plans to bring back. Next summer, the company plans to sell its Nintendo Entertainment System Classic Edition, which will include 30 games like The Legend of Zelda and Donkey Kong. The company has not yet announced its release date. Search and rescue begins in Florida Keys, by Jennifer Kay and Doug Ferguson for the Associated Press in Miami. Aid rushed into hurricane-scarred Florida early Tuesday. Residents began to dig out, and officials slowly pieced together the scope of Irma's vicious path of destruction across the peninsula. Even as glimmers of hope emerged from parts of the state forecasters once worried would be razed by the storm, the fate of the Florida Keys, where Irma rumbled through with Category 4 muscle, remained largely a question mark. Communications and access were cut, and authorities dangled only vague assessments of ruinous impact. "It's devastating," Florida Governor Rick Scott said after emerging from a Monday flyover of the Keys. A Navy aircraft carrier was due to anchor off Key West to help in search and rescue efforts. Drinking water supplies in the Keys were cut off, fuel was running low, and all three hospitals in the island chain were shuttered. The governor described overturned mobile homes, washed ashore boats, and rampant flood damage. A stunning 13 million people, two-thirds of the third-largest state's residents, plodded on in the tropical heat without electricity, and nearly every corner of Florida felt Irma's power. In a parting blow to the state before pushing on to Georgia and beyond, the storm caused record flooding in and around Jacksonville, causing untold damage and prompting dozens of rescues. It also spread misery into Georgia and South Carolina as it moved inland with winds at 50 miles per hour, causing flooding and power outages. Six deaths in Florida have been blamed on Irma, along with three in Georgia and one in South Carolina. At least 35 people were killed in the Caribbean. More than 180,000 people huddled in shelters in the Sunshine State, and officials warned it could take weeks for electricity to be restored to everyone. "How are we going to survive from here?" asked Gwen Bush, who waded through thigh-deep floodwaters outside her Central Florida home to reach National Guard rescuers and get a ride to a shelter. "What's going to happen now? I just don't know." The governor said it was way too early to put a dollar estimate on the damage. During its march up Florida's west coast, Irma swamped homes, uprooted trees, flooded streets, snapped miles of power lines, and toppled construction cranes. Around the Tampa-St. Petersburg area, where Irma rolled through early Monday, damage appeared modest, and the governor said damage on the southwest coast, including in Naples and Fort Myers, was not as bad as feared. In the Keys, though, he said, there's devastation. "It's horrible what we saw," Scott said. "I know for our entire state, especially the Keys, it's going to be a long road." He said the Navy dispatched the USS Iwo Jima, USS New York, and the aircraft carrier Abraham Lincoln to help with relief efforts. Emergency managers in the islands declared Monday the Keys are not open for business and warned that there was no fuel, electricity, running water, or cell service, and that supplies were low and anxiety high. "Help is on the way," they promised on Facebook. The Keys are linked by 42 bridges that have to be checked for safety before motorists can be allowed in, officials said. The governor said the route also needs to be cleared of debris and sand, but should be usable fairly quickly. In the Jacksonville area, close to the Georgia line, storm surge brought some of the worst flooding ever seen there, with at least 46 people pulled from swamped homes. The Jacksonville Sheriff's Office warned residents along the St. Johns River to get out now. "If you need to get out, put a white flag in front of your house, a T-shirt, anything white," the office said on its Facebook page. "Search and rescue teams are ready to deploy." A tornado spun off by Irma was reported on the Georgia coast, and firefighters inland had to rescue several people after trees fell on their homes. A tropical storm warning was issued for the first time ever in Atlanta, and school was canceled in communities around the state. More than 1.5 million customers were without power Monday night in Georgia. Irma, weakened to a tropical depression, is expected to push into Alabama, Mississippi, and Tennessee over the next 2 days. People in the heavily populated Tampa-St. Petersburg area had braced for the first direct hit from a major hurricane since 1921. But by the time Irma arrived in the middle of the night Monday, its winds were down to 100 miles an hour or less. When that sun came out this morning and the damage was minimal, it became a good day, Tampa Mayor Bob Buckhorn said. How the iPhone has changed over the past 10 years, by Lisa Marie Segarra. Apple's iPhone has come a long way since Steve Jobs introduced it in 2007 as a combo iPod, a phone, and an internet mobile communicator. Over the past 10 years and 15 models, Apple's smartphone has taken numerous forms that can be fascinating to revisit with the benefit of hindsight as we wait for the company's new iPhone to be unveiled on September 12th. Watching the evolution of the iPhone is part mesmerizing and part nostalgic. It's been a while since the iPhone has looked like its original self, especially after the iPhone 4 brought a complete design overhaul with a flat front and back made of glass, which was as breakable as it was beautiful. After that, the changes were less drastic. We saw iPhones get thinner and lighter, while the iPhone 5 got longer and added another row on the screen for apps and folders. You'll see a noted difference with the iPhone 5S, which was the first to be launched with iOS 7. The software update changed the entire phone's aesthetic, moving away from the skeuomorphism and closer to flatter and borderless designs. The iPhone 6 brought another major change, altering the shape of the phone, which grew bigger once again and added a curve to the edge of the screen. There may be even bigger design changes afoot at Apple's keynote Tuesday, where the company is expected to unveil an iPhone 7S model, as well as a rumored 10th anniversary phone that could be called the iPhone 8, iPhone X, or iPhone Edition. Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the Daily Edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.